Coming up on Fronteras, farmers in South Texas are angry with Mexico.
They're not good neighbors. I mean, my neighbor right there, if they have a problem, I run over there and I help them.
We look into a water dispute that's fueling tension between the two nations. And the Department of Homeland Security's Secure Communities program seeks to deport immigrants who've committed serious crimes. But in California alone, activists say
7 out of 10 did not have what immigration itself considers to be the most serious offenses.
A bill making its way through the state's legislature seeks to curb that federal program. Details next, but first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. The Rio Grande River is the lifeblood of South Texas. A 70-year-old treaty between the U.S. and Mexico is supposed to keep the river's water flowing. But Mexico has fallen behind on its end of the deal. That's heightened tensions between the two countries and jeopardized the future of agriculture in the Rio Grande Valley. From our Fronteras desk, Mónica Ortiz Uribe reports.
At the end of a long, hot work day, farm laborers heave heavy sacks of red jalapenos onto a metal scale. A supervisor calls out their weight.
66.
These peppers will be smoked into chipotle, a signature crop in this area. We're near the city of Delicias in the northern Mexican state of Chihuahua.
81.
The pungent scent of chipotle penetrates the roadsides here at the end of August. These dehydrated chilies, smoldered till they're brown and wrinkled, look like a cruel caricature of the soil.
We've had a water shortage for the last 2 years.
Homero Chavez farms just outside Delicias. Drought knows no borders. Farmland in Chihuahua is just as parched as it is in Texas and New Mexico. Farmers here only got 1/3 of the water they needed this year.
If you don't have enough water, it will reflect on your prices drastically sometimes, you know. And your profits will go down, of course.
To survive, Chavez had to buy water rights from other farmers who couldn't afford to plant this year. Barren fields dot the Chihuahua landscape, some overtaken by weeds. The sky finally opened up in late July and delivered a much-needed soaking. The excess rain caused this small local dam to overflow, sending a new gush of water into Chihuahua's Rio Conchos and ultimately downstream to the Rio Grande. That's how Mexico delivers most of its water to the United States under a treaty signed by both countries in 1944. Currently, Mexico is behind by 38% on its deliveries.
Mexico has an obligation to deliver a minimum annual average of 350,000 acre feet in cycles of 5 years.
Sally Spiener is with the International Boundary and Water Commission, the federal agency that oversees binational water treaties between the U.S. and Mexico.
We basically set aside water in the United States reservoirs that will be released and delivered to Mexico. We do not believe that the Mexican system is managed in a similar fashion.
In fact, it's not. Jesus Luevano works for the federal agency that represents Mexico under the binational water treaties. He confirmed that irrigation districts in Mexico do not set aside water to meet their yearly obligation.
Because usually with the rains in the past, we were able to comply with Mexico obligations under the treaty.
But since the drought hit in 2011, Mexico could no longer rely on the weather, and their low water deliveries have struck a heavy blow to both sides of the Rio Grande Valley.
We're down to the bare bottoms of the bucket.
Jojo White heads the Mercedes Irrigation District in South Texas. He drives his pickup past fallow fields checkered with wild sunflowers. In better years, you'd see healthy rows of cotton, onion, and grain.
Half of the farmland in the district was not planted because there wasn't any water. That has never happened.
Another year with scarce water could wipe out the farming industry here. A study by Texas A&M University estimates the economic loss would be $400 million and some 5,000 jobs. Cities would also be in trouble since they depend on irrigation canals to deliver their water supply. Among locals, there's a certain bitterness toward Mexico. Joe Pennington farms sugarcane outside Raymondville.
They're not good neighbors. I mean, my neighbor right there, if they have a problem, I run over there and I help them.
In an effort to turn things around, Mexican water officials are finalizing a new set of rules that would require Mexican irrigation districts to set aside water for the Rio Grande River. These new rules could go into effect as early as October, but both countries are still stretched thin for water, so the challenge of finding better ways to share and conserve remains. In El Paso, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
After Arizona enacted SB 1070, a controversial bill that empowered local police to enforce federal immigration law, several states followed Arizona's lead. But California's trying to go in the opposite direction. From San Diego County, Adrian Florido reports on a proposed bill that some have dubbed the anti-Arizona bill.
One afternoon in late June, about 100 people, mostly young Latinos, marched to Escondido Police Headquarters. They were kicking off a caravan to Sacramento. This is Viviana Gonzalez, an undocumented immigrant.
We're pushing for the governor to sign the Trust Act this year because it's important. Communities like Escondido have seen the brunt of what it means to not have something that protects immigrant families.
The Trust Act is a bill now working its way through the state legislature. It would put limits on the relationship that local police and sheriff's departments have with federal immigration agents. Here in Escondido, immigration agents have been present at police traffic checkpoints and in city jails. Activists say this degrades public safety because immigrants are less likely to report crime if they fear interacting with police could get them deported. Before explaining how the Trust Act would try to address this, it helps to know what happens when someone is arrested. Here at San Diego County's Central Jail, among the first things is a fingerprint scan on electronic machines. These prints are sent to the FBI to be checked against crime databases. But as Captain Dan Pena explains, since 2009, there's been one more step.
Those records will be shared with ICE.
The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, launched a program called Secure Communities. Under the program, once the FBI gets information about an arrestee from a local jail, it sends that information to ICE.
They'll be able to review those records to see if there's anybody that they have any interest in terms of immigration violations or things of that matter.
If ICE is interested in someone, it sends a request back to the arresting jail, asking that the person be held for up to 2 days until an immigration agent arrives. The program has helped the Obama administration deport nearly 2 million immigrants, a record. But if passed, the California Trust Act would prohibit jails from honoring ICE's request for a 2-day hold. They'd instead be required to release someone as soon as they've posted bail or become otherwise eligible for release, unless that person has been convicted of certain violent or sex crimes. Advocates of the bill, like John Rodney with the California Immigrant Policy Center, say this would correct what they see as a major problem with secure communities.
The original intent of this program was to focus on people who do have serious convictions. But when we look at these 100,000 Californians who've been deported, we see that about 7 out of 10 did not have what immigration itself considers to be the most serious offenses.
ICE officials refused to comment for this story, except in a statement saying their priority is deporting people who pose threats to public safety. San Diego's police chief and others across the state have supported the Trust Act, but San Diego's sheriff, Bill Gore, has not taken a public stance. The State Sheriff's Association, however, is opposing the bill. Aaron McGuire is its lobbyist.
You get a request from a federal law enforcement agency and to say that you should basically willfully disobey or not cooperate or to thwart that request from law enforcement puts local law enforcement into a difficult position.
He also believes the bill should allow local jails to hold someone who's previously been ordered deported for any reason. The bill doesn't allow that because past deportations may have occurred for minor infractions or none at all. It was last year that Felipe Porcayo's 23-year-old son was arrested after a fight broke out here at San Diego's Memorial Park. He says police determined his son was not involved and didn't charge him, but he was turned over to ICE and deported anyway. If the Trust Act passes, those kinds of deportations may be less likely. The bill actually passed the state legislature last year, but Governor Jerry Brown vetoed it because while it still allowed people with certain serious convictions to be turned over to ICE, some crimes were left out. This year, Assemblyman Tom Amiano of San Francisco has worked with the governor to amend the bill. In May, it passed the Assembly again, and it now awaits the vote in the Senate before reaching the governor's desk for a second shot at his signature. In San Diego, I'm Adrian Florido.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. A closer look at the train that recently derailed in Mexico. It's known as the immigration train, the Beast, a dangerous ride for many Central American immigrants. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Investigations continue into the derailment last weekend of the train in Mexico known as the Beast. It's known for ferrying Central Americans through Mexico, many en route to the U.S. At least 6 Hondurans were killed in the derailment, and at least 16 others were critically injured. Fronteras desk contributor Lorne Madelon has been on that immigration train. Lorne, where exactly did you hop on, and what did you see?
Well, I jumped on at a quick stop about an hour south of Coatepec, Veracruz, Mexico, and it was a night in 2010, and I remember more the sense of place than anything else. It was a surreal, sometimes frightening, sometimes extremely friendly experience with people, all Central Americans, Nicaraguans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, who wanted to transit Mexico. And I had heard stories from a Mexican congressman that I knew that these people were being abused to the point that he wanted to introduce legislation in the lower house, the Mexican Congress. And he wanted to make sure that this was decriminalized. The act of passage through Mexico without documents for people almost always headed to the United States. And it didn't pass. And he remains, as a former congressman, very upset about it. But the sense of place, I remember, Crystal, a cloud of mosquitoes, very thick. You could barely make out the lights of a train. And the train that you call the Beast is known as La Bestia in Spanish, and it sounds almost more ferocious. And people both fear and almost revere the chance to get on it because it's the best of a whole bunch of really horrible options. I met a man named Guillermo Ramirez. He runs a Casa de Migrantes. That's a safe house for Central Americans in that town, in Veracruz, a small town. And it's a town that he said lies right on the path of death. And, you know, that's a very strong statement. And, again, I had heard anecdotal evidence of that. And then I started to talk to people that he protects in his safe house. There's an unwritten understanding between the authorities, the church, and the people who run these casas de migrantes in this town, not across Mexico, but in this town, to leave them alone. So they were safe there. It was a safe house. And that casa de migrantes is right on the tracks. I mean, you open the door, you walk a foot and a half, and that's where the tracks are. And people would gather sometimes for weeks on end waiting for the right time. The right time didn't necessarily get represented by the next passage north of the train, a train that would start at the Guatemalan border and then head north. It would start as people gathered at nighttime. Shadows would move across the tracks, and undocumented men and women from all these Central American countries would stand out there. And as they did, and as I spent the night in the Casa de Migrantes the night before, they were telling me that, listen, if we don't get on this train, a train that's controlled by organized crime, there's Mexican police, extortion gangs get on the train. And they said that's our best option.
But it's a dangerous ride. I mean, what happens to people when they are on it?
Well, they feel a sense of, you know, trepidation, a sense of fear, but also a sense of relief, because that means that they don't have to deal on the road with numerous checkpoints on the road. What's happening on the train? So I rode it for about an hour. You know, the people with the real experience are the people who ride this for 2 weeks, staying awake for days on end. I rode it for an hour. And why did I do that? I obviously stood out. I didn't bring the camera on the train. I brought it on, but it was hidden. It was really frightening. It's very dark. You can hear the echoes sort of clanging off the metal of these empty freight cars and people talking softly, but then the noise gets just ferocious, and people are looking around, and they don't know if they can trust the person they're looking at on that. And the reason for that is that gangs will get on. They'll stay on for a day and a half, They do just terrible things.
How many Central and South Americans actually use that train to get to the U.S.? Do we know?
You know, I know what authorities in each country say. The Mexican government says 400,000 Central and South Americans cross illegally into Mexico every year. There are people inside Mexico, activists who are advocates for immigrants passing through, who dispute that. They say it's slightly less. What we do know is that whatever that number is, it's certainly, you know, a six-figure number, and it's enough that there is a sadly an ongoing market of extorting these people, and you know, both mostly led by police in collusion with criminals in the south of Mexico. Some of the people coming north are seasonal farm workers. The vast majority are coming to the United States. The U.S. Border Patrol estimated in 2010 that nearly half would make it. That would mean that there would be 200,000 Central and South Americans transiting Mexico who actually are successful and make it into the United States. That sounds like a lot of people. I was mentioning before, Crystal, that the migrants say the train is the lesser of two evils. You know, on the road, they're facing police checkpoints. They face people who want to kidnap them. They people who want to rob them. And unfortunately, and this has been documented and it's very sad, the treatment of women passing through there is brutal. Not uniformly, but there are so many examples of women being abused on that train, getting onto that train, on the roads in southern Mexico, trying to transit Mexico. I spoke to a Cuban lady who had managed somehow to get by boat to from Cuba to Mexico, had no documents. She happened to be the beneficiary of good training in Cuba, spoke perfect English. Obviously, her Spanish was great, but she said, you know, they can tell I'm not from here. They can look at me. They can hear me speak. As you know, the accents are different. On the train, these people, once they make it, they have to pay bribes in many cases, not always, but too many to report, to armed gangs. They control who gets on, who gets off, in some cases, who gets thrown off. And these people, as if you can imagine, going through this terror. Right.
There have been calls, like you said, for the Mexican government to do more to protect Central American immigrants. Have they done anything on that front?
They have done what so many times happens in politics. They have said the right thing. They have echoed the right platitudes. And the answer to your question, unfortunately, is no.
What happens now with this derailment? Do we know how the deadly derailment might impact future immigration?
I can tell you that this has happened before, not as spectacularly. I mean, people are killed there weekly. Not through train accidents, but accidents on the train. And sadly, the only reason there's media attention on it right now is because of the horrific nature of this derailment. I don't think it's going to affect anything. I think there'll be a temporary slow passage through this particular area until the tracks are repaired and the damage is removed. And unfortunately, I think it's a certainty that death toll will rise because they haven't removed everything yet from the tracks. And there's a real possibility that people who... You know, there's no passenger manifest. We don't really know who was on there, but there's a real possibility existing that more bodies might be found. That being said, people are going to line up to take this train because the economic imperative drives everything. There's obviously a need in the United States that's being filled by these people, and so they're going to continue to come. People are going to continue to employ them.
That was Frontera's contributor Lorne Madelon reporting. Las Vegas is a city of transplants from all over the country, and these days, all over the world. The influence of Asian immigrants has brought new tastes to the city and new flavors to Las Vegas tacos. In the last story in our series on making the taco our own, Frontera's reporter Kate Sheehy introduces us to a Las Vegas native, the Comex taco.
It seems a lot of taco stories start this way.
One day, as we were making our lunch, somebody came in and they said, "Hey, what is that you're eating?" And my husband said, "Well, do you want to try?" So he gave him a sample of that.
That's Linda Yi, a Korean immigrant who moved to Las Vegas 11 years ago from L.A. She and her husband, Sonny, were running a Mexican meat market when they started experimenting with the flavors of the two cultures.
And so the guy liked it, and then he left, and his cousin came back and said, "Hey, sell me the same thing you just sold my cousin."
And thus was born the Comex Taco.
Okay, that's fine. I'll take your two orders together. Go right ahead.
Linda and her husband, Sonny, opened Comex in 2011. The wildly popular Korean-Mexican fusion restaurant is tucked away in an unassuming corner of a small strip mall on North Decatur Boulevard.
Okay, we've got chip salsa and guacamole. These are all our hot sauces. This one's Mexican, and those two are Korean.
Awesome, thank you. I'm going to have a
Waitress Shauna Duncan juggles the cultures as she juggles the tacos, burritos, and nachos that pack a surprising punch to the taste buds of first-time diners at Comex. Comex adds the distinct flavors of Korean barbecue, called bulgogi, to traditional Mexican-style tacos and other typical dishes. The beef is marinated with sesame oil, soy sauce, and sugar. E says it is similar to teriyaki, but not as sweet, and the pork is made with a sweet chili paste. Customers can also choose pork belly or calamari. Pico de gallo goes on top of the tacos, along with a cabbage slaw that is tossed with sesame oil and soy sauce.
Kimchi on request. Kimchi only on request. Nothing really comes with kimchi unless you ask for it.
Duncan says a lot of people do ask for this slightly sour Korean side dish of fermented vegetables and spices. Curtis Platt is from California. He says he and his family always stop at Comex when they're in town.
I get the beef or the pork, and then it's there's just something about the kimchi with everything else, the sweet and hot, that I like. It's a little different than just regular Mexican food.
Billy Ann Watanabe brought a few of her fellow teachers to eat lunch.
I mean, it's unique for Korean and Mexican fusion, and their bulgogi beef is awesome. I'm half Korean, so it's pretty good.
Linda Yee says the success of Comex shows how the U.S. is changing.
Because we're such a big melting pot here in America, people are recognizing that, oh, it's okay to have a, you know, hot dog that's made a little differently or a taco that's made differently. It tastes just as good as what you're used to.
Still, Yee says she never imagined people would love this fusion as much as she and her husband did. Yee says they plan to open a second location in the southwest part of the city by October. In Las Vegas, I'm Kate Sheehy.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversations and post your thoughts there. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.